heart and soul of a nation, beckons the call. The voice of our forefathers heard in the distance.
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
To reclaim our honor.
Our soul. The challenges of a generation call out. Future generations hang in the balance. We choose liberty. This is the voice of a nation. And now, Malcolm.
As he describes it, he was in his late teens when he and his fellow soldiers landed on Utah Beach. Greeted by a hailstorm of machine gun fire, mortar shells, and heavy armament, the door of the landing craft opened and they jumped into the water. Many of them were dropped too soon, and as they stepped off the boat, well, they sank to the bottom and drowned. Well, Irving goes on to describe how every soldier had a 47-pound backpack, a 3-pound helmet, several hand grenades and extra ammunition around their waist. It was about impossible to swim. Having come in on the second and third wave of men, there were dead soldiers everywhere. Many were floating in the water. Well, through God's good grace, Irving and his men all made it in alive. And friends, that is from World War II. This was a global moment in time, 1939 to 1945. But that was a moment in time. But what defined that moment in time more than anything, it is often described as the greatest generation. When you think about the character of the people who not only saved America, but saved more so the world, saved civilization is really the better way to say it, humanity. I mean, it could have been a whole different outcome when you consider how this ended and how World War II was, you know. Well, today we have a special privilege. Irvin Locker, who is now 95 years young. He was drafted into the Army right out of high school, just a kid from New Jersey. And he was sent to fight in one of the most monumental battles in World War II, D-Day, Battle of the Bulge. Irving, you think back to that moment as I described there, the words there of that scene coming in on Utah Beach. I want to start right there, brother, and I want to bring it back to that moment of time. Bring us back there, please. And I mean, it's hard for anybody to really imagine that, as you say, the landing craft opens and the guys start jumping out. Bring us right there.
Well, basically, there were 30 of us that wound up on the Higgins boat. Now, the Higgins boat is where the front door lies down, and that's when you jump out and either go through the door or jump over the side, etc. And surprisingly enough, the sailors on the Higgins boat was taking us in, but then picking up our dead and wounded and going back. So they were getting killed just like we were, even more so, because they had no protection on the boats. Right. But anyway, to start off with my lieutenant, we got about 11 feet, 10 feet out, and the sailor said to my lieutenant, "You better get your men ready." So he took out his 45 and walked over with a smile on his face and said, "Either you take this boat in so my men don't drown, or you're never going to see your family again." But in the meantime, I was 5'6" at that particular time, and we got into 5 feet of water, and they had to drop the door because they were shooting at us, etc. So he dropped the door, and can you imagine with that load on my back, jumping into the 5 feet of water to try to get to that shore? And all I kept hollering about is get off the damn beach, because you know you're a victim once you're on that beach. But there were more dead Americans than you can ever imagine at that time that we were coming in. Because you have to realize that they had the complete beach was mined. And they had these poles, they call them the Rommel candles. The poles, they took poles, trees, and made poles out of them, put them into the ground, and put mines on them, because they thought if we were going to invade at all, we would come in at high tide. If we came in at high tide, not knowing the poles were there, the ships would just hit that pole and we'd all get killed and the ships would sink. When our observation planes flew over and saw all those poles in the water, we had to come in at low tide. Coming in at low tide, it extended the beach another 30 yards or 300 yards all the way around the line. So we were totally exposed. And in between these poles that they had, it was all barbed wire to keep us out. So basically, there were more dead Americans when we were coming in on the second wave than you can ever imagine that they did. So that was basically a start of how we came in and how we survived. If you tripped in any which way, you were so top heavy that if somebody alongside of you didn't help you back up, you drowned beside them shooting at you besides that. So basically that's how we came in to the beaches.
Yeah, I'm trying to visualize, and the descriptive here, Irving, is how you describe it here. You talk about an adrenaline rush. I mean, everybody was at their highest alert, obviously. How close? I mean, first of all, it's a miracle that you're here today. Do you agree with that?
It really is a miracle, and I thank God every single day that I am here today because of what we went through going in on that.
Yeah, think about that a moment here. How many of your fellow soldiers, many of your friends, people that you were in the armed services with, how many of them didn't make it through?
Well, quite a few did not make it. But basically, the latest record right now is there were 9,000 soldiers lost on the beaches between the five beaches that we went. There were five different beaches that we went in. The Americans went in on two, and the rest, the British, et cetera, went in on the other three, Gold and Juno. But we went in on Utah and Omaha, and I went in on Utah Beach. So the latest figure from what I remember and what I've been told is 9,000 were dead on the beaches. So you can't even imagine what it was like.
No, you can't. You can't really at all. How close did you come through that whole experience? How close did you come to meeting your fate?
No, we did comparatively well. Omaha Beach took a worse beating than we did because the planes flew over the beachheads and were supposed to drop the bombs to destroy the beachheads, etc., because of whatever preparedness they had. Utah Beach, we did pretty good. But when it came to Omaha Beach, the clouds were so thick and heavy that the pilots were told to hold their fire 10 to 15 seconds. Mm. They missed the complete beaches, the complete front of the beaches. They landed, the bombs landed behind and off, but they did not destroy all the guns and all the different things. Now, you have to understand, there were mines.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Complete mines on all the beaches. I would say at that particular time, every 5 feet there was another mine to do that. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact that we went in with 90 millimeter guns on one condition only. We were told, or headquarters was told, that Rommel was going to put tanks on the beaches to keep us out. Because you shoot a gun at a tank, or even our tank shooting it, it could not break through the armor. We had the only ammunition. Now, my ammunition, the gun, I had four of these guns under my command. The guns were 9.5 tons, each gun. The shells that we fired were 3 feet tall and weighed 45 pounds each shell.
Wow.
So we had two separate shells, one for planes, and we had the only ammunition that could go through the armor on a German tank. That's why we went in on the second wave, because of that situation. Otherwise, we would have not gone in that early because of it. But they needed us to defend not only the tanks on the beaches, but all the men coming in, the ships, the supplies, everything that were coming in on the beaches. We had to shoot the planes to knock down the plane to protect those beaches and bridges so that we could bring the men in. So basically, that was our purpose.
Yeah. And you know, there hasn't been a moment. I mean, you talk about a moment like this here in World War II. There hasn't been a moment like that since. I mean, that really was an ultimate battle, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. How old was you there? How old?
19. Drafted at 18. We went into Fort Dix and then went into North Carolina and then went in, of course, to the battle. 19 years old.
So when you say you went into the battle, what kind of time? By the time you entered into the military to the time you went into battle, what are you talking in time?
Oh, less than a year.
Yeah. So you were I
was drafted right out of high school.
Yeah. How long did you end up serving?
3 years.
3 years, yeah. Yeah. And this here, at this moment here, a year in at this battle here. So from that battle, as you say, you described coming into Utah Beach, you say you see the dead Americans, they're everywhere, yeah?
Everywhere.
And so
everywhere.
When you're seeing them everywhere and you're getting off as just a young 19-year-old man, really just a young kid, I mean, so what goes through your mind at that point? And I'm wondering here, is it survival? Is it anger? Is it survival? Is it fear? What are the emotions that goes through a 19-year-old mind?
Two things. Number one, fear. Mm-hmm. Fear. Okay. Number two, the long life that we thought we were going to have could be shortened.
Instantly.
Mm-hmm. And that's what goes through your mind with that. But
now when fear comes into your mind, when fear is there, and let's think about this a minute, because your life is hanging by a thread, like you say, you're 19 years old and fear is there. So when that kind of fear enters your body, does that, I'm guessing now that would give you probably more strength, more adrenaline, more kick-ass attitude, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
At that particular minute, yes, it had to be because you had to get the hell off that beach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
you better believe
and that was they kept hollering, and that's basically they talked about the fact that we're on your beach. When you're on the beach, you're a victim. Mm-hmm. When you're off the beach, you're a warrior.
Gotcha. And yet you've got all this weight on you.
True.
Like you say, you've got all this weight on you. So your idea now is to become a warrior and not be a victim.
Absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely correct, because you had no alternative. You realize that you have no alternative but to get the hell off that beach.
Right. Even when you're on the beach now with all that weight on you, it's got to be pretty difficult to move with that. I mean, that slows you down tremendously, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Don't forget, we came in without the guns.
Okay.
The guns, and incidentally, just as a point of information, the guns were 9.5 tons. Putting them from one ship to another, we lost one of those guns into the ocean, into the channel.
Mm-hmm.
So we lost one of those guns. And basically, after the war, the French pulled it out and et cetera. So I'll tell you that afterwards, a little later.
Yeah.
Once we got the guns in, mm-hmm. and we brought the Caterpillars, the mm-hmm. Caterpillars were a full-track unit, okay, like a tank, only opened up so that we attached the gun, because it was had full-track unit, because we couldn't use wheels, we couldn't use tires because of the sand and later on because of the snow and ice. So it was a full-track unit, we call them the Caterpillars, that pulled the guns and 14 men of that gun. Every gun had 14 men assigned to a gun.
Yeah.
And there were four guns to a battery, and there were four batteries. So there were 16 guns plus headquarters. So we were all in there fighting for our life, basically. But once we brought the guns in and mounted that and got them ready, then it was a different ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, you had rifles, hand grenades, and that's what you were shooting. Because don't forget, they were shooting at us. Plus the mines, mm-hmm. plus everything that we talk about now. One of the biggest problems, even after the beach, was they had signs, Achtung Minen, that means attention mines.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know whether to believe it or it didn't. So many of our men lost arms and legs and were killed because they stepped on a mine.
Yeah.
But the Germans had signs. Don't forget, they were so far ahead of us with everything that they had created in war, because Roosevelt did not want to go in, and it took 3 years until they bombed Pearl Harbor that he said, okay, we're going in. But other than that, the Germans were so far ahead of us that it was unbelievable with what they had prepared.
Boy, it's amazing to hear you talk and say what you just said about Roosevelt, and you think back to history. But I'll tell you, the outcome of World War II could have been a whole different event, huh?
Oh, it really was, because people had no idea. The Germans were so far ahead, people have no idea. They had miniature tanks called Goliath, miniature tanks that could go underneath our tanks and blow us up.
That's amazing.
I lecture till today. I have a PowerPoint, and I lecture till today because people have no idea what it was to that point. And let me bring out another point that's so important to me and should be to your readers. One of our men in battalion headquarters, somebody in battalion headquarters, wrote a chronological order of every single day of the war for our battalion. It was printed in Germany and then translated into English, and I was awarded, me and several of my men were awarded that book. So I have that same book now that I lecture about it and I talk about, so that I could refer to every single day of the war, what we did, how many planes we shot down, how many tanks we destroyed, and artillery, to the point people have no idea what it was. I could shoot 30,000 feet up into the air with that gun. I had the only armor-piercing shells that could go through the tank. Now, Rommel was going to put tanks on the beaches, basically, to keep us out. We went in with 90-millimeter guns, with the only ammunition that could go through the armor on a German tank because of that. Otherwise, we should never have gone in on D-Day. But because he put tanks on the beaches, we went in with it. So these are the historical facts. So I have everything in writing to that point that I can tell you every single day where we were and what we did, etc. And incidentally, beside that, with the artillery, I have actual proof that the 106th Infantry was surrounded by the Germans. They called us in. I could shoot 6 miles over their head. And it's in writing where we knocked out the Germans with their guns and saved that battalion from annihilation, that battery from annihilation. And everything's in writing, and I didn't write it. So these are the things that we talk about that people have no idea what it was.
Well, listen, you have an amazing piece of history, brother. I mean, you are a big part of history. And, you know, we're talking here, you know, listening to you go play by play and moment by moment here. We're talking 75, 76 years ago here.
Yes, you are.
And you
yes,
talk you like are. It was yesterday. I mean, it's
well,
amazing.
Let me tell you something. Because of the PowerPoint, I mean this sincerely from the bottom of my heart. I'm trying to give back. I am so grateful to be alive.
Mm.
I don't charge for any of my lectures. I drag everything, all of my, I brought back a great big Nazi flag I took off a wall in Berlin.
Yeah.
Because we stopped at the Elbe River. Anybody who could understand German mm-hmm. was sent into Berlin to settle the little towns, etc. after the war. I'm Jewish. The Yiddish language of the Jewish people is a derivative of German. So I could understand a lot of the words. I couldn't speak their dialect. But my gun was educated. When I held it to their head and clicked it a few times, they did exactly what I told them to do. Mm-hmm. So it was an education problem. But these are the things I talk about to that point that people have to understand what we went through and what this war was all like,
yeah.
what it was all about.
Now, so much has changed now in the way that we conduct wars now. They're no longer the way they were back then. I mean, they're totally different now. And the world has gone so much digital now, so it's a whole different structure. But also what's changed, Irving, and some of the things I want to talk to you about today, are the young men and women, the generational changes, and which gets right. into our values as a people. And there's something about the greatest generation and the values of those young men that were fearless. We talked about the word fear a little bit earlier here, but they were fearless in a lot of ways and changed history, which is amazing here. Now, I want to ask you something. I don't want to fail to ask you this here. How many heroes are left today from World War II?
Oh, I can't even imagine. Number one, the word hero is a word that who knows, in whose estimation, like the President of the United States called me a hero. I mean, I wasn't a hero as far as I was concerned. I did my job. I did the best thing that I could. So as far as a hero is concerned, I don't know. I can't answer that question as to how many heroes. Whoever gets publicized to the point of like Murphy and some of the other ones, they're heroes. But we all did our job. We all assigned a job, and we did the best we could to that point. I talked about the fact of the signs of Achtung Meinen. When we had, when we got a march order to go 10 or 20 or 30 miles or 50 miles, I would go ahead. I would go ahead because I was a staff sergeant. Mm-hmm. I would go ahead to make room to make sure when my guns lay down, I would place each gun where they're supposed to be. Now, basically, when I had 20, 30, 50 miles, I would take a man with me with a mine detector. When we had 10 miles to move, I couldn't have the time to take a mine detector with me or a man. I would jump into a Jeep and do that field and run that field, even though there were signs, Achtung Meinen, and run that field because my men were on their way and I didn't want anybody killed. So go talk about a hero. I wasn't a hero. I was doing what I'm supposed to do.
Sure, but heroes never call themselves hero.
No, so I can't.
Understood.
I'm not a hero in any stretch of the imagination.
Well, we would consider you one, but you're not supposed to. That's correct.
No, I'm not.
I understand, but listen, the president, let's talk about the president a moment here, because he called you out. He called you out in an amazing moment. And let me tell folks that, and you will know, because I'm sure many of you listening watched the State of the Union, where the president spoke, and I'll call out again, three heroes, I will call
right.
them. And I want to play that audio feed right now for folks. It's only about a minute or so, but here's the president of the United States.
In June, we mark 75 years since the start of what General Dwight D. Eisenhower called the Great Crusade, the Allied liberation of Europe in World War II. On D-Day, June 6, 1944, 15,000 young American men jumped from the sky, and 60,000 more stormed in from the sea to save our civilization from tyranny. Here with us tonight are three of those incredible heroes. Private First Class Joseph Riley, Staff Sergeant Irving Locker, and Sergeant Herman Zajcik.
So as you hear this amazing speech here, the State of the Union here, you see the name that he puts out there, the president, Irving Locker here. Now, when he says Irving's name, by the way, you might remember, folks, when you watch that on the television set at the State of the Union, Irving was the guy who stood up with his hand and his fist and like that. And he was like, that was so cool when you did that, Irving. You know what I'm talking about? The way you shook your hands. Trump does it too that way. Trump does his hands. That shows victory. It was cool. What was that moment like?
But I was amazed. Let me explain something. When I was invited, I thought I'm going to be sitting in the audience with World War II veterans or veterans. Okay, I even took opera glasses with me so I could see what the president looked like, because it was such a secret. I couldn't even tell my family we were going to Washington. That's how strict it was. When we got there, until we got lined up, etc., I did not know I was going into the gallery until 10 minutes before I was put in, and his wife was sitting there, and his daughter was sitting there, and the two other veterans and me were invited in. And I never dreamt, because they said to him, he may call your name, he may not. Nobody knew what he was going to do.
So you didn't know you were going to be the main event, did you?
No, never. I never dreamt it, you know? So when he called my name, I was really so surprised that I jumped up with my thumb up into the air, because I never dreamt that
Your body language was truly amazing. It was magnificent. Yeah. I just watched it just moments ago, by the way. And to remind myself, and of course I've seen it live when it played as well, but I remember the moment, and you were so enthusiastic in your body language. It reeked of just inspiration. You were inspirational, Irving. That's what
Well, because the other veterans, I had to help stand up and help them sit down.
You could say.
I never dreamt that it was going to be, you know, like that.
No, and you were like, you were the rallying guy there, ready to, you know, rally everybody on. Hey, listen, the other two guys, had you met them before? Did you know them?
No, only in Washington. That's all.
So you had met them there. But what I learned today is you didn't even know this was going to happen until, that's amazing, 10 minutes beforehand, and then you're on.
10 minutes. It was such a security situation that I swear to God, right. It was 10 minutes before that they said to me, you're going in. Not my wife. My wife couldn't go in with me. Only the people who brought relatives needed the help to support them.
Right.
Walk or help them stand or sit or something.
Right.
So my wife was not even there. She had to stay in the
And room. Then at that moment of time, here you are, 10 minutes you don't know, and then 10 minutes later, the whole world is watching you.
The whole world is watching me. Absolutely.
The audience on that State of the Union is one big audience. I'll tell you, want to hear what the president's got to say. Was that the most or one of the most magical moments of your life?
Yes, absolutely. No question about it.
Yeah.
And then I went into the White House. I went into the Oval Office with him. Mm-hmm. We were invited to go in. Now, a point of information that I'm talking about, and I'm not talking politics. He is strictly a gentleman and a real businessman. Now, who am I to sit in the Oval Office talking to the President of the United States on a one-to-one basis and kibitzing and joking and telling him a joke and making him laugh?
And when did that happen? The next day?
Yeah, in the Oval Office.
Yeah.
Well,
let's do this here. I want to take a pause here, and then there's someone else I want to bring on the show with us as well, on the program here as well. And I want to talk more about the president, that visit to the Oval Office and all of this. I got to tell you, people, what a joy for me I've done a lot of program and a lot of shows, but it is truly a privilege for me to talk to Irving today and to bring him to all of you. You know, being a patriot myself and being, you all know how I am, you have to understand what a thrill it is for me to have Irving here and to talk to all of us. It is truly a blessing. And so, and then, you know, you hear him. And wouldn't you know that that's what he would say when we say, he says, well, I'm not a hero. Well, of course he would say that, clearly. But you know as well as I know, people, he is a hero here. And so many heroes from that era. It really was and is the greatest generation. And it's an interesting shift when you look at how time has gone on. And the question becomes this. How do we preserve those American values that really made this nation what it is? Because, friends, without those American values, we are nothing moving forward. And you probably at this point of this conversation should have goosebumps on your body right now, because I know I do. More Voice of a Nation in just a moment. It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue: Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
It is, how do I say to you, to me, it's like, it's the new 60 when you're 95, huh, Irving? Is it the new 60?
Right, absolutely right.
You're the new 60, brother. I mean,
I'll take it.
You better believe you'll take it. You'll take it standing up or sitting down.
Absolutely.
But you are amazing. And you know the other amazing thing, Irving, I have to say to you, is when you stop a moment when you were talking early on and you say, you know, Malcolm, I count my blessings every day. And you know full well that the Lord had a different plan for you, that God had a different plan forward, which is really why you feel so blessed. When you think of how fate could have played it so differently, I mean, the way you've lived your life, I wonder how different it's been knowing that every day you live is a blessing when you know the results of and the fate of that day could have been so different, huh?
Absolutely. You have to realize that 90% of my men were deaf in both ears from the shells and the guns that we had, that we fired. A shell was 3 feet tall and weighed 45 pounds each shell. Now, can you imagine firing those guns? And I was in the middle of four of these under my command. And thank God I can hear and I can talk and I can see. So, my God, when I tell you I thank God, it comes from the heart, not the lips. And it's such a true situation with me on it, because we're ballroom dancers besides. So we go dancing yet besides. My wife is 90 years old. We're married 71 years. We celebrated 71 years of marriage, and we still dance, and we still cruise, and we still tell jokes, and I'm still happy to be alive.
So after you came back is when you met her, or did you know her when
after we came back.
Is when you got married, but you met her then. Okay, got it.
I met her after we came back. And you want to hear a true story. We're two brothers married to two sisters. I went to school with her older sister, and I introduced my older brother to her older sister, and they got involved and got married, and that's how we got together.
Wow.
With my wife and I. So we're two brothers married to two sisters, and it's an amazing situation.
It is, and 71 years later, and she's still putting up with you, huh?
And she's still putting up with me. That's for sure. You know, I was awarded the French Legion of Honor, but I think it was because I'm married 71 years, never mind the battle.
Yeah. Now, oh, what a terrific moment here. All right. So I want to talk about President Trump a moment here, and then I want to bring somebody on the program as well. But let me first ask you, I want to get that experience when you visited the White House. I mean, I already know, as you expressed 10 minutes out, you realize you're going to be introduced, you're going to be in the gallery and be on the State of the Union. And really at that moment, Irving, you became part of history for the second time. You were, think about it in those terms, brother. You were part of history back in World War II, back 75 years ago, and here we are. You are back again, part of history at the State of the Union with President Donald J. Trump. Now you're at the White House the next day. Tell me about that day, please.
Well, it was really an honor, to the point that he brought each of us to the Oval Office. My wife and I, we met him, and we met the vice president. We met the president's wife, all separately and talked to each one independently. And I talked to him basically, and, you know, I keep saying, who the hell am I to be sitting in the Oval Office with the President of the United States? So you can't even imagine the honor and the privilege that I felt. And we talked about the fact that here was a man who could have anything his heart desires. He had enough money to do anything he wanted, and he gave it all up to make America great. And all he got from that point on was 7 days a week, 24 hours a day of abuse.
Well, I was going to ask you, what kind of a job do you think President Trump is doing? But I think you're telling me right now.
I think he's a marvelous. I think he's doing a in my estimation, I'm a businessman. Mm-hmm. And in my estimation, to run a country like this, you have to be a businessman. And he's a businessman. We don't need politicians that are looking out just for themselves.
Amen to that.
I don't want to talk politics, but that's my honest.
Yeah, no. Well, he's Citizen Trump. He's Citizen
that's
Trump that goes to Washington.
My honest belief. That he's a businessman, and he's doing whatever he can, and he's got to make deals one way or another with everybody around the world, mm-hmm. you know, with the different countries and everything else. And so as far as I'm concerned, you need a businessman to do that.
Well, we need more citizens to get involved because the political class have taken it over now, brother. You know,
absolutely,
and that's both parties, both political parties are corrupt.
Yeah, I'm not talking politics.
Yeah, no, they're both corrupt. They're all corrupt. Come on, buddy.
Absolutely.
And so we need more people like that. And you know, Trump is a moment in time. It's historical what's happened here. It's totally
historical.
Absolutely
right.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, well, let me bring on another friend here to talk to us because he wrote a piece about you on America Out Loud, which was a fantastic piece. And it was called, his column was called, The Values of the Greatest Generation Must Be Shared. And it was our weekly columnist and dear friend here and part of the America Out Loud family, Sid Bowditch, is here. And Sid wrote the book, A Rush to Judgment, A Journey with Trump, God, and Love, that is on Amazon and on the America Out Loud bookstore. Go look up Sid Bowditch and read his columns on the platform. He's, I think, a brilliant writer and an amazing patriot and just, again, another blessing that has been part of our family here at America Out Loud. We love Sid. So everybody loves reading your advice, your columns, and your thoughts, Sid. So Irvin's in the White House the next day. And so he says, Sid, he says, well, who the hell do you heard him just moments ago. He says, well, who the hell do you think I am to sit here with the President of the United States? You know, and you hear his term again, thinking he's not worthy of that. Like when I call him hero, you know, I got news for him. And here's the real message, Sid. The President is sitting there on the other side of the desk or in the chair there. And he says to himself, this is him talking to himself now. And Mr. Trump says, who the hell do you think I am sitting here talking to this hero here from World War II who helped save civilization and save humanity from destruction? Who am I to sit here with this man here, Irving Locker? The President was probably saying that to himself, Sid.
Without a doubt. And yes, Irving was the inspiration for that column that I wrote. I am truly blessed to live close to Irving and his beautiful wife, Bernice. We get together with them and we're great friends. We love each other and I love him. It's such an honor to be able to be in the presence of somebody like Irving. It really is. And you're right. Even the President recognized that.
Absolutely.
Fact. You know, the thing is when, you know, when Irving says I'm not a hero, but when you hear that I was 19 years old and I drove a Jeep through these fields to blow up and expose any mines so that my guys wouldn't be hurt. Mm-hmm. That's a hero.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I looked it up, by the way, while we were talking here, guys, just so you know, there were 291,557 battle deaths. So almost 300,000 people lost their lives in that battle. Yeah. Okay. 113,842 other deaths in service that are non-theater and 670,000 non-mortal woundings, what you described as Irving, limbs lost and majorly injured.
Absolutely
and
right.
Life totally screwed up forever. And so, and according to the Department of Veteran Affairs, by the way, there are still about 495,000 American veterans from the war were estimated to still be alive. This was just this end of this past year. Can you believe that? Still quite a few.
Yeah. Let me bring out a point here, because I'm very active with all the wounded veterans, and I live in the villages. There's a gentleman now, which is a miracle, stepped on a mine, lost both arms and both legs, by the name of John Peck. They just put arms, not prosthesis, but real arms on him and attached the nerves so that he could touch, he could feel. He just got married. That's a miracle as far as I'm concerned. And we are so active with all of these veterans that were wounded. And I'm so grateful that it wasn't me and I'm still alive, that I can do anything in this world to help these veterans. But this is a miracle that he's the only one that I know of that they put real arms on him, not legs, but real arms where he could touch, he could shake hands, he could put his glasses on, he could feel.
So he had real arm transplants done, and this is a man.
Real arms transplanted and the nerves attached.
Think about how much we've moved the meter forward. They couldn't have done that back then. How old is this man approximately? No. How old is this man approximately? Do you know?
But he's an older man. No, younger man. Younger man. Vietnam or younger man.
Well, a lot of the men that come back from battle, a lot of them are seriously, again, they're post-traumatic stress disorder is a big deal.
Oh, my God. And I'm very active, even getting dogs, service dogs. I went and visited there in the villages where I live. There's a women's prison that helped train the dogs for the veterans. And I was invited to come in and lecture to them there. And it's an amazing situation how they train the dogs to help the veterans, even to push a fountain so the veteran can drink, pick up things, do different things with the dogs. So I'm very active with all of these
things. The dogs are amazing. Hey, Irving, did you struggle yourself with PTSD at all?
No, not at all.
I get the sense you didn't, which is why I ask you the question. But, I mean, how many did not suffer? That's amazing that you had no effects from that war.
I don't know, but I know that I thank God every single day of my life because of that. So I just feel somebody was watching over me to that point. And I can't imagine why. When I talked to you, that we had no ear protection. We had no toilets, no sinks, no showers. And we lived through those things to that point that it's unbelievable. I have so many stories to talk about as a procurement officer to go out. And I was the biggest thief. I would steal chickens and eggs and hay and straw for my men to try to make them more comfortable living in a foxhole. There are so many stories that people have no idea. I spoke at a school and talked about the fact that we had no toilets, no sinks, no shower. And the girl stood up and said, "You had no privacy when you went to the bathroom? Oh, my God, how could you stand that?" I said, "I'm in the wrong place. I got to get out of here." You know, but people have no idea, no idea what it was or what we went through in a war.
I want to talk to you next, Irving, and Sid both, about I want to talk to you about the values, but I want to talk to you about how the world has changed a bit here, because I'm thinking in the terms that you must, as I know we do, pinch yourself to really understand truly how upside down the world seems to be these days, Irving. You know, I know Sid and I would attest to that for sure, and I'm sure you probably agree with this.
So would I, absolutely.
It's something you can't even put your arms around it, truly. There's so much not quite right with the world right now. And I want to talk about that. And let me read this paragraph here that Sid, you wrote in your fantastic article. That's, again, there'll be a link when this goes to podcasts. It'll be a couple of weeks after you hear this on Talk Radio, but you will be able to get it on demand. And there will be a link to Sid's article and column as well, as his book as well, friends. But this is called the article he wrote, the weekly column, "The Values of the Greatest Generation Must Be Shared." And Sid says this: "Be it on the ground, the air, or the ocean, these men were heroes." There's that word again, heroes. "Hundreds of thousands of them gave the ultimate sacrifice to save our allies in Europe from a fascist dictator murderer, Adolf Hitler." And I just talked about the hundreds of thousands. I just gave you the numbers on that war, people,
absolutely,
a moment ago here. And then Sid says, why? Values, that's why. The values which most Americans lived by back then were many. And most were tied into Christian family values, such as respect, honesty, community, faith, freedom, integrity, humility, kindness, honor, discipline, compassion, accountability, fidelity, and love of God and neighbor. And so, Sid, you open it up there, and then you talk about most Americans lived by the Ten Commandments. And then you say, as we hit the 1960s, well, things started to change a bit. And you get into some of the communist socialists and disguised now where we see they are trying to take the country and by taking God out of society. So what you've done in from your vision, Sid, is you've kind of stepped back and you're looking at the world in a, from a different perspective than most are out there, I think, is what I've uncovered from you. And a lot of your writings, which you talk about God and you bring him back into the conversation, rightfully so, as we all do on America Out Loud. But I think you look at it from a different perspective than most. But tell us about this, why this is so important, and the fact of the change in society that you've seen over the last really 50 years, brother.
You know, I've written some other columns relative to our moral compass. And, you know, it's very clear today that as a society, we have lost our moral compass. And it's really because of the socialists, the Democrats, the liberals. They don't believe in God. They're doing everything they can to take God out of society because they're very much aware that without God, we will be a completely immoral society. And that's what has been happening. And fortunately, you know, there are still people around like Irving who can tell you, hey, I fought for those values. And we all need today to fight for those values, because without those values, we are done. This country was based on Christian godly values. When they came here from England and the colonies were started, this country was based on the belief in God and Christian values, family values. Without those, we are done as a country. So if we don't fight for those, we don't recognize them, we don't talk about them, we don't try to bring them back, and we don't fight for them, more importantly, we're done. And that's why, that's what inspired me to write this column.
Irving, when you step back, brother, you hear Sid lay a good preface down there of what we're talking about here. When you step back now and you look over the last 50 years and certainly over the last 75, since you left Utah Beach, actually you go back that many years, but even the last 50, what kind of changes are you seeing in society, talking about generational now? How do you feel about the changes and where are we headed?
Associated with my Army career, the kids today know nothing about the Army. They know nothing about the sacrifices. They know nothing about World War II. They're not taught anything about it. And I think that's a disgrace to the point of taking history out of the classes of the school, because the kids today know nothing. When I talk to the kids today about anything, and like I said before, I can't even get through to them as to that certain amount. You know, certain amount of children respect me, and certain amount of children come to visit me and want to know about it and different things, and that's great. But as far as anything else is concerned, to me, the children today are interested only in themselves. And when I talk to parents about it, they want everything free. They want everything for nothing. You know, like the parents owe them their life, and that's it. So.
Well, haven't though we done that in a lot of ways? Haven't the parents, the generation you said, corrupted these kids and raised them accordingly? I mean, in other words, we gave them everything they want, Irving. I mean, they want a phone, we give them a phone. We give something else, we give something else. We've spoiled the hell out of them, haven't we?
I agree 1,000%.
Well, why have we done that? Why is this generation corrupted things so badly?
Well, only thing that I can think of is that the parents who have lived through some of the problems that we have today don't want their children to relive it.
Interesting. Or
so they're grateful that they're giving back everything that they can for nothing. As far as I'm concerned, people will object to it, but like in Israel, everybody has they graduate school, they have to go into the service. Because when you go into the service, I don't care if it's Army or Navy or what. You can learn a profession, you can learn a good job, but you take orders, and if you don't take the orders, you're punished, whether it's peeling potatoes or digging a hole or something. But today, I talked to the kids today, there's no such thing. They want telephones, they got telephones. Everybody today has got a cell phone. Everybody today, their parents give them a car.
Back to values. How can you have values when it's all given to you? And Sid, let's pick up on that, because Irving explained something interesting when I asked him the question. And so what I gathered out of that is that there was a bit of guilt from this society that wanted to, maybe because of the hard times they went through and some of the difficult moments of life, and maybe they're trying to make it easier for their kids. And by thinking they were doing the right thing, Sid, they gave everything to the kids, which made it easier because the kids didn't have to work for anything, or they certainly didn't have to struggle for it. Let's put it that
right.
way.
Right.
Is that
right.
Well, here's, is that part of the problem?
Well, it is. And here's my answer to that is, again, you take God out of society and what happens? Divorce increases, right? So people don't stay married based on the values of staying married, because you're supposed to stay married. You took a vow and you should stay married. So as divorce increased through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, parents, single parents, more and more became guilt-ridden with their kids being fatherless or motherless, in most cases probably fatherless more than motherless. And quite often, and of course, I think it's a more of a female tendency to then, I don't want to say overparent, but to make up for, you know, because they feel bad. We all feel bad for our kids if they're hurting. So if they're hurting, then what do we do to make them feel better? Well, we let them do this and we let them do that. And we don't hold the standards that we used to have. Respect. I mean, look at the respect that's lost in this country today. And that's a lot of that is lost even between children and parents.
Sid, we talk about the fact of me being 71 years married. You know, the kids can't stay 71 minutes today married to that point. And it's really not, it's not there. The love and the fact is not there to hold them together. And they got to go through problems and troubles, and it's not there today, so that's what it is.
Gentlemen, do you listen to this? Do you know one out of every two marriages will end in divorce?
Absolutely.
Not surprised.
50%. It's just over 50%. It ranges in that range, but we're talking one out of every two are divorced. We'll get divorced.
Right.
Let's talk about this, guys. Let's take our next five to six minutes left we've got, and let's talk about how do we steer this road back, the values. How do we get back to a safe area now from where we've come? And so if we look back over the years now, we look back at where we are right now. Irving, let's have you start off here, and then we'll go to Sid.
I'll start off to this one point that I firmly believe.
Please.
These kids are given everything that their heart desires, everything that they want. Now, once they get married, they have no idea what it is to support a wife and a family, to go out and make a living, and to struggle to do that.
Interesting.
So the value of that is not there to the point that they were never brought up that they had to work for their money, or work to do this, or work to do anything else. They don't work.
Some of everything that may even contribute to the divorce rate, you're saying then.
That's what I'm talking about. They
wow.
can't handle wow. the responsibility and to go out and support and pay rent and pay taxes. And where the hell does it come from? Unless you're brought up with it, unless you're taught what it is to work. I'm the baby of seven children. I'm the only one of the seven children that graduated high school. Everybody had to go to work. My father, God bless him, was a shoemaker. During the wintertime in New Jersey, if it snowed or rained, people would put cardboard in their shoes because they couldn't afford a shoemaker.
Yeah.
So my last year of high school, mm-hmm. I worked from 3 to 11 every single night in a gas station.
Simpler world back then, Irving. It was a simpler world. You know, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have technology, you didn't have communications, you didn't have cell phones, you didn't even have fax machines at that point. There was no technology.
But you have to understand, we didn't know that either at that time.
That's right, brother. That's right.
We didn't know that.
I don't believe it. Yeah. No, you're right.
Well, here's what I put it. You can just boil it down to almost one thing, gentlemen, and that is sacrifice. Okay. What is sacrifice creates, it strength in people. If you sacrifice, you're creating strength in people. You know, there's no sacrifice today. Kids don't sacrifice for anything. Look at Irving at 18, 19 years old. He was sacrificing his life, for goodness sake, to save a country. Kids don't know what sacrifice is today. So the character is not there like it was way back when. And that's all part of the values. But how do we get back to them? To answer your question, Malcolm, because I know Irving has a time constraint. How do we get back to that? It's this. And it's happening in Florida and it's happening in other states. God is slowly being brought back into society. There have been some laws recently put in place in Florida where In God We Trust, for example, is now putting back into schools. So this thing's happening. We are making some progress in terms of bringing God back into society, which would bring God back into our family and create family values. Without them, we're lost. And that's why I wrote this column on the values of Irving's generation, the values of being willing to sacrifice your life for the betterment of others.
It's a beautiful
that's
thing.
Lost today.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Irving Locker, we salute you today, brother. We salute you every day.
Thank you. Yeah. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for giving me the opportunity to give back to anybody that I can.
Well, you are certainly a blessing. You're a shining star. And we absolutely applaud you, my friend, and thank you for all your service. And as we thank all of the men and women who serve in our armed forces here, it was one of the earlier things that America Out Loud was always affectionate about, our military, our men and women who serve, and also the men and women who serve here at home in our law enforcement as well. And that comes back to, again, values and understanding the importance factors of society, which Sid points out very well there. What a privilege it is to have Irving here with us and to talk about bringing values back, people, and what it takes to do that. It's a generational thing, and it's something we need to be mindful of. I got a lot of ideas from just listening to this show and listening to Irving today and Sid. I got more ideas myself on things we should do and could do better. For this generation to bring it back here. So, again, what a moment of time. You think about 71 years he's been married, but think about 75, 76 years since the World War II, since he stepped on that beach there at Utah Beach and became what he is. And then the President Trump saluted him and celebrated him in his life at the State of the Union. A moment in time for sure, and an absolute privilege here, friends, to have him and hear his voice here. Certainly, you would agree with me when I say an American hero. And friends, let's all bring values back to the game here in every way that we can. It's time to get involved and get loud.